night, this very night. Sili Mizik, our old favorites doing the Afro-Haitian and Pan-African sound, are going to be at the Milky Way in Jamaica Plain. And that show starts at 9 p.m. tonight. Also, if you hurry right now, you might be able to catch Gladys Monterroso's speech happening here on the MIT campus, giving a talk about the day that changed my life forever. She is a torture survivor from Guatemala. It's presented by the Guatemalan Solidarity Committee, and the room, I believe, is 4231. Does that mean it's building 4, you guys?
Yeah, if you Google it, you can find what 4231 is, but MIT buildings are all numbered, so that's why.
That is tonight, my friends. Tonight, very much happening in mere moments. So here on the MIT campus in Cambridge, it's building 4, room 231. And next week on Monday, on the 2nd, that would be, in addition to what the folks from La Tusa were telling you about, there's also going to be a presentation on Monday night, 7 p.m., from the Mexico Solidarity Network. And this is also here on the MIT campus. This never happens in our announcements. It's going to be a discussion about autonomous education from Chiapas to Mexico City. Urban Zapatista Links with Patricia Hernandez. I believe that both that and the presentation tonight are presented in Spanish with translation into English. That event is in Building 4 as well, room 253 on Monday, November 2nd. Y ahora tengo que repetirlo todito en español, ¿verdad? Okay, so esta noche vamos a tener a Sili Mizik allá en el club Milky Way en Jamaica Plain. Este show empieza a las 9 de la noche. También hoy esta noche acá en MIT se puede escuchar la charla de Gladys Monterroso empezando a las 7 esta noche acá en el edificio 4 de MIT. El cuarto es 231 y ella va a hablar de su experiencia como sobreviviente de tortura en Guatemala. Pues lunes, el 2 de noviembre, ya saben que vienen otras presentaciones, pero este lunes también acá en MIT se puede escuchar Patricia Hernández. Patricia Hernández hablando de la educación autónoma entre Chiapas y la Ciudad de México, acá en MIT, en el edificio 4, otra vez, el cuartito 253. Y como siempre, pueden saber un poquito más de todo eso buscándonos en el internet. Se puede mandarnos una cartita electrónica a esferio@wmbr.org.
Thank you, Amy, for those announcements. So we're about to go off, but I hope you enjoy listening to our show. Again, you're listening to WMBR Cambridge.
Cabon. Yes, I say marhaban to you here on Music for Human. I am a doctor, Janis Sakran, and I welcome you. I'm here with Professor Levine, Professor of Jewish Mysticism. Professor, welcome.
It's great. It's great to be here once again, and I have to say that today my pleasure in joining you, Dr. Jalas, and all the listeners out there is quite sharp. It's a quite sharp desire. I feel like we can often think about our pleasure and desire and infer some sort of shape or color or smell to it to help us understand it. And today that I feel that my pleasure in joining everyone in the circle is very sharp and pointed.
Yeah, my experience there is that certain relationships between people are like a meal, you know, or like a set of meals.
Oh, like cornmeal.
Like yes, cornmeal, or indeed like a nice roast turkey.
Hmm.
Some people are that way. They really are like heavy, and it's difficult to compare. But I think the analogy is very complete.
Hmm.
So I feel after eating a large piece of goat where the meat has been cooked perfectly
for several days
and therefore simply dissolves, that there are, and you know, every bite is wonderful until you are perfectly satiated. Some individuals are like this, and others are more like you know, a taffy.
Hmm.
And you know, it tastes very nice at first, but then your teeth begin to hurt and some of them stick to the candy and may be removed.
Yeah, and I think that some people are like perhaps a warm lemon. The fresh juice of the warm lemon is slightly pleasurable and clean, but also bitter, and one can't stand too much of it.
But simultaneously, you know, it's not that they become less tolerable. They simply somehow are always there, are constant.
And I guess if we push this idea a little further, we could say that a single individual may be like a very strong spice, and perhaps they can't really be appreciated on their own. So you may not be able to have a one-on-one relationship with this person, but when they're part of a group of many people who represent many different spices and flavors, they blend together into the perfect dish.
Yeah, I can see that. Or maybe more generally, that an aspect of a person's personality can be similar to food, to a particular flavor.
Yeah, I think we can use food, flavors, we can use shapes and colors and sounds and smells to describe every component of our mental and spiritual lives. So I said before that my pleasure in joining everyone today was a very sharp pleasure. And I meant that it's very intense and pointed, and it probably won't last very long. In fact, it may not last more than another minute or two.
Let's both take a moment to really savor the current flavor before it passes.
Mm.
It's gone.
Yes. I no longer feel any pleasure, but I don't feel any displeasure either. I feel fairly neutral about being here right now. In the midst of this neutrality, I thought I might throw a question that I've been thinking about for a long time to the doctor.
Please do so.
Yeah, and this, I've been thinking about this, and I don't know if anyone else has ever had this question before. I may be the first person to have thought of this question, so perhaps you may not have an immediate answer. But my question was whether you believe that people, throughout their lives, whether it's possible for them to ever change themselves.
Whether a person can change, like, similar to an object accelerating itself independently of an outside system?
Well, even with an outside system, I mean, whether a person who has a particular habit, maybe it's the habit of eating too much ice cream every day, or the habit of overindulging in sleep, whether it's possible for that person to change their habits and to really change their inner core. And of course, in the New Age literature, there's many books about how to better oneself or how to think positively. And I often wonder whether these books can truly bring about fundamental changes in people.
Well, I think we could even extend this question because, you know, books are like, they are like flavors. And they are like animals in that they are an experience which is temporary and in some way becomes it becomes a part of you and then it's simply gone.
I see. So I guess the question is whether a book is like certain foods or others. For example, it may be like a satisfying meal, which your body processes and takes some nutrients out of before it passes through the remainder, or whether it's more like corn, which the body is known to pass straight through its digestive system.
Without processing at all.
Yes.
And, I mean, similarly, one can ask this question about psychotropic medications and other substances. All of these things have there is some effect which is immediate and some durable effect which remains with the person throughout their lives. And I think that a person's essence remains independent of these things. My intuition is that what in fact happens is that your perceptions of things change, but your core remains the same.
I see. So if someone, say, is employed at the circus and working as a clown, as many of us do, then we could truly say that they came from the womb in the form of a clown, although it may not then have been apparent.
Well, this brings up the question of destiny. But to me, what I actually mean is that these flavors are the same, that a person might be, you know, coriander or might be garlic inside. But circumstances will determine which of these spices are brought forth. However, it is impossible for a person who does not have the onion inside him to bring forth this flavor.
Mm.
Just as the plant who is not an onion cannot simulate the flavor of an onion. You will never modify an orange so that it tastes like root beer.
So now I can extend this thought one step further. In my own experience in the great art of cookery, I've noticed that one often needs to dry roast spices before grinding them, and this helps bring out a very pleasant and pungent aroma, which is the aroma of the spice, but is otherwise latent in the spice until brought forth by the heat of the skillet. And I guess we can say the same thing about our inner essences. Many essences we have may remain latent until brought out by some heat, an external flame. And often this flame takes the form of another human being who can draw out our essences in the form of a guru or a lover.
Yeah, and this last thing, I think, is what's really can be vexing, because another person who is sufficiently skilled can cause you to emit all sorts of flavors and various aspects which you may have desired to have remained hidden and latent, or indeed in many cases which you were not even aware were hidden there under layers of patterns and behavior that have been there all your life.
And that have also perhaps accumulated. I think sometimes we head in the wrong direction, and instead of revealing our inner essence, we accumulate layers of crud and crust over ourselves. And I wonder, actually, if you think people who have bad breath and bad odors emanating from their body, whether that's the sign of a rotten inner core.
Well, I think it's a sign of something. I mean, certainly the absence of foul odors does not indicate that a person is clean inside. But a person who is not attentive to his own cleanliness, is that not significant?
Well, it is said in the Jewish Talmudic tradition that those very righteous people who are favored by God emit a heavenly odor redolent of the Garden of Eden at all times, even after death. So their corpse, while undergoing rigor mortis, instead of emitting the foul, pungent odor that we're all used to from corpses, instead will emit this heavenly Garden of Eden scent.
But who's to say that that our perception of smell is aligned with that of the universe? Indeed, I believe that our sense of smell has been repurposed towards selecting what is fit to be eaten, or what is fit to being approached.
Mating behavior, I guess.
Perhaps, but certainly not towards detecting changes in character, which is unfortunate.
I know that some scientists have concluded that these sweat smells that we often consider unpleasant can actually lead to some form of attraction.
Yeah, I'm certain that that's true at some level. Well, as always, the program is not about us disseminating our views. It is about, communing. So if you'd like to call in and join the circle, the number is 617-253-8810, and we have two callers now on the line. Caller one, marhaban.
Namaste.
Namaste, caller.
How are you?
Well,
Dr. Jealous.
Very well, thank you, caller.
And how about you, Jewish scholar?
Well, my pleasure in joining us has passed, but I feel neutral now.
Well, that's good.
Caller, let's bring a fourth voice in to join us.
Absolutely.
Caller three, marhaban, you are on the air.
Bobby Ponchi.
Welcome. Is it Arthur?
Namaste.
Marhaban, Arthur.
Really a great show. I think you've hit the hammer on the nail.
That is always our goal.
Yeah, I think what I wanted to add is, you know, you have the people who see God in everything, God manifest in everything, and they might say, you know, let's say you've got some math.
Yeah, and it's a very lovely view that, well, you know, just earlier how you mentioned the hammer, at once an image appears in my brain of a hammer being struck to the by a nail, but obviously although the image was your intention, that is not actually your meaning. And I think similarly, when people speak about God or a nature or the universal force or gravity or indeed death, that they are all referring to the same thing, but these are all metaphors, and we've all invented metaphors, ways of reminding ourselves how we would like to behave.
Well, I wanted to go back for a second to this issue of our inner core being expressed as a spice. And I wonder if our two callers would be able to tell us what spice they think is most representative of their own essence.
Well, you know, ironically enough, I don't listen to this show all the time, but I've actually been on this show before as a caller, and I remember a similar conversation, and that time I confessed that my inner soul is smelling of nuts. Just every nut that you can think of is kind of condensed into one scent, and that kind of emanates from me wherever I go. So that's still my answer.
Yeah, it's quite an image again that we have interacted with a person who is simply nuts. It's somehow resonant.
Well, you just turned the tables on me there. Yeah, I don't have anything to say to that. That's, you know.
Well, I think there's
the core.
No, caller, I'm not criticizing. I think the nut is a beautiful.
Oh, no, I have a sense of humor, so.
Well, I think it's a beautiful and somewhat meaty food, and certainly
crunchy too.
Yeah, and it represents simplicity that I think few would admit to.
Yeah, I mean, on a serious note, it really has a lot of, you know, applications. You can make it into a milk or a paste or a butter. You can smear it on your friends, or, you know, cats like it. Dogs really like it.
And I wonder about this idea of
flip and slides.
All the nuts being condensed into a single nut. And
yeah.
I know there's a spice that's called allspice.
Yeah.
And I only recently learned that allspice is just, in fact, not all spices, but a single spice, which I think is very disappointing.
Mm-hmm.
I at
that's,
first thought when I terrible. When I first bought allspice, I expected every spice to be represented.
Yeah, or at least a couple, you know, at least like the top 13.
Yeah, but it's just one, really.
But one?
But it's so flavorful, and although one may imagine that in such circumstances that the person who is responsible for rendering the name in English simply was unimaginative,
or very egotistical, perhaps.
Perhaps he was named All,
yeah.
Or you know, Professor All, or
well,
Doctor All.
The spice that he discovered, he felt, was all spices combined.
I see.
Yeah.
It'd be like if I discover a planet and I name it All Planet,
or the best planet.
The best planet.
Planet.
He could have been a New Age guru. He could have just said, "This spice is one with all spices." So I'm just gonna try to get this across to people by making the spice called the allspice, and perhaps when they cook, they'll reach enlightenment.
I think that's an interesting leap, because I mean, similarly, curries, which are actually spice blends, many people think are, you know, is a single spice.
Although there is the curry plant, which is distinct from a curry.
Yeah, so there really is no winning here with language.
I wonder for caller two.
Go ahead.
Arthur, are you there?
It seems we may have lost Arthur.
I was going to ask him what spice he feels represents his essence.
Well, what spice do you feel represents his essence?
Something light and positive. Mm-hmm. Maybe cinnamon.
Or orange zest.
Orange zest, yes.
I was thinking more garlic salt.
So that all represents sort of our different experiences of this.
And maybe also going back to this question of change, whether change is possible or whether we're just removing outer shells and layers and revealing our true smell and essence. I wonder if the caller has felt that he's ever undergone a true change to his personality or his character or his soul.
Definitely. I've not always been this nutty person that I am now. As a child, I'd think I'd be more of a kind of cinnamony, maybe an apple cinnamon type flavor. And as time went on, I realized that that's not really who I wanted to be. So I made a conscious effort to kind of change that and make, put more nuts in as time went on. You know, I started out kind of with the cashew, kind of appealing to everyone, integrating that more into my personality. And as more and more real savory flavors came in, it kind of pushed out the more light, the light stuff and replaced it. So I still have that fun, appley flavor, but it's in the guise of almonds. And I still have that cinnamon flavor, but it's now in the guise of walnuts.
And something that I think we don't often consider is that, you know, just as all of our visions and really everything that we experience visually can be broken down into three component light wavelengths, that similarly everything that we can smell likewise is very digital and can be broken down into a number of component smells.
Yeah.
So,
well, you know, there's a phenomenon called fragrines, which are actually the equivalent to smell that photons are for light.
The true particles and essences that we turn into our olfactory experiences.
Right. And, you know, most of the time we think of smell as kind of a wave, but according to quantum mechanics, but there's also a particle for that, and so all smell is a wavelength of a fragrance, according to Niels Bohr, I believe.
That's really a fascinating theory that I have to admit I was not aware of.
Yeah, well, I mean, Niels Bohr didn't say it, but he implied it, and so a couple people picked up on that, and
I always thought the name Niels was kind of interesting. I mean, Neil itself, of course, is a name. Is there more than one Neil? Are there Niels?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think it started in Scandinavia as kind of just people who are kind of sexual deviants, because BJs weren't really accepted back then. And so they'd just be like, you know, Neil, all the time. And to be able to have this accepted in public, they'd say, oh no, I'm just repeating my name because I just met this young woman, so I wanted to remember my name. But really, he's looking for a little bit of that,
So what's actually happening here is that the parents are looking out for their children in the choice of the name.
No, actually, I think most people named Niels actually at some point decided, okay, Mark is not good enough for me, or Charleston is not doing this for me in my life.
So you're saying it's my choice.
It's a chosen thing, and usually there's some sort of vision quest that goes along with it. So you go out in the woods, you see a deer, you have a dream because you haven't, you know, because you're lost and you haven't drinking water in a while. And in that dream, you know, you're getting lots of BJs and you wake up and you're like, my name's Neil now.
Well, I...
You go in and revolutionize the standard model.
I think also that that there is some lesson here, which is that that a parent may wish to control their child's flavor or destiny, and they may try to push them in that direction, but it is an unchangeable essence of each person that that hence cannot be changed and can barely be directed or contained.
Well, of course, nowadays everyone's talking about designer babies, right? Everywhere you turn, there's a discussion about designer babies.
Well, yet another
futile
attempt to control something which cannot be controlled. We are delving deeper into an essence that cannot be changed.
Well, at least maybe superficial physical appearances perhaps can be altered, such as height and nose lengths and hairiness perhaps as well. But I wonder if perhaps one day through New Age understanding we'll be able to develop a way of doing some sort of spiritual designing of our babies, not through crude techniques such as genetic engineering, but through understanding the phases of the moon, for example, in terms of the interaction between moon phases and our own mating behavior. We might be able to produce offspring that are aligned with certain spiritual characters. In fact, we may even be able to choose that our first child will adhere to a particular religion based on their spiritual signature.
I think that this is alarmingly close to designing robots. And that's right. The idea that you would be able to specifically select your child's inclinations and to a great degree their behavior.
Yeah, and who wouldn't want to select their own robots? I mean, I think that's why people are so excited about it, is because it's amazing. It's great. You know, who in their right mind would say, I don't want a little robot that looks like me, and, you know, to be able to pick out its eye color and, you know, how deep the dimples are. It's just so cute, you know?
I think that what actually will happen, if I may take a moment to make a prediction, is that just as parents have over time invented more and more invasive ways of directing their children's destiny, children will invent more and more obscene and violent ways to reject their parents' control. I mean, now a person may become upset at their parents for selecting a particular name. Can you imagine that a designer baby would become upset at their parents for the eye color?
Yeah, because
it's interesting. Well, there are certain things that are better than others, though, in a certain basic sense. Like, right now, a lot of what designer babies are kids that have been weeded out and filtered for certain types of mental illness and for, you know, certain basic diseases that are really easy to figure out, you know, to connect to certain DNA strands. So that, I think that's the first thing, is that kids who are going to be sick are getting weeded out. So those kids are going to be like, well, thanks, I don't have, you know, cancer, so appreciate it.
Or simply, thanks, I never have existed.
Yeah. And I think that's the best thanks of all, because it's just like, wow, I saved a lot of undue suffering, and I didn't want to deal with that, so...
Well, I wonder, it's often said that certain ages of children are very difficult to deal with. We say there are the terrible twos and the fearsome fours and the fearsome fives. And I wonder if we can design design our children to skip years. So they would immediately go from age...
Born at age 15.
Born at age 15, but perhaps teenage years are unpleasant too, so perhaps... Born at age 2, since infants are kind of a pain to deal with, born at age maybe 1 to 2 is fine, skip age 2 because it's terrible, allow age 3 and 4 because they're cute, and then jump to 18.
That's very interesting, but I'd like to go back to the caller's point, which is that by preventing a particular child from existing, we would be reducing their suffering in certain cases. But, you know, I think there is a point which must be made, which is that would the parents of a future despot have wished to ended, to have ended their lives earlier, you know, to have prevented their birth? Because that really would have ended a great deal of suffering.
Well,
even though the child was not programmed to develop cancer or other unpleasant things, that if that child had suffered, it would have actually reduced the sum total of human suffering. And how can we predict something like this?
I think it's a matter of statistics, and you can't reliably predict what kid's going to grow up and cure cancer, or what kid's going to grow up and make the next, you know, Sistine Chapel painting. But you can reliably predict what kids are going to grow up to have a giant hump coming out of their gonads. And so, you know, you just have to do what comes, you know. And I think once things get better and you're able to more accurately predict, you know, what is this kid going to get in his math score in mm-hmm. 15 years, then we'll be able to do more accurate stuff.
What I'm trying to say is that greater and greater control is not the answer. The answer is that we need to engineer our society better to make this sort of control unnecessary.
Well, yeah, I think if you know, that's another great point, because if you go down the street and you ask an average person with a baby, you know, what sign were they conceived under? You know, what house was Jupiter under when this baby was conceived? They'll have no idea. Most people just have no idea, and they're just reckless, going around, you know, thinking all these baby books and baby formulas and baby food is gonna bring up a healthy kid. Really, it's meditation that's basically the only thing that's gonna, you know, ensure that this kid's core comes out. And no amount of you know, apples and carrots mashed up in a plastic container is going to help those kids out.
Yes, in my counseling to married and pregnant couples, I've always said that meditation needs to start in the womb. In fact, one can incorporate meditation practices for their unborn child very easily. In fact, most unborn children are quite predisposed towards meditation since they really can't do much else.
Yeah. They'll kick when the conditions aren't right for meditation, because that's kind of annoying.
Well, the kicking is actually usually an attempt to perform a difficult yoga pose.
Oh, okay. I guess it could be a combination of both. You know, that makes sense. Is that the tree?
Well,
shuddering tree pose.
I don't think that Professor Levine was indicating any one particular pose.
Any difficult yoga pose?
Yes, usually any yoga pose is fairly difficult to perform in a very constricted environment such as the womb.
True.
I mean, usually our yoga studios allow better freedom of movement than the womb does.
Mm. But at the same time, you know, certain very important hygienic issues and you know, other practical concerns are gone when you are fed through a tube. So I think that's there are benefits.
Yes, there's something to be said for it.
Yeah.
Speaking of hygiene, I actually was just applying some hand sanitizer to my hands, and it's a kind of citrus, light citrus flavor, but underneath it, there's this hand sanitizer scent, which I find surprisingly pleasant, actually.
Be attractive, yeah.
And I actually think that this might be a representation of my inner essence, this hand sanitizer scent.
Cool.
Mild citrus overtone.
Yes, Simone. This might be one of the days that's changed your life. So kudos on your journey.
I used to take my old photographs and rub rose petals over the lost loved ones that that had been depicted there, and occasionally to decorate them in other ways.
I tend to put smiley faces on their heads, like little yellow smiley face stickers,
just to really contrast with the solemnity of the moment.
Well, to also ensure their happiness in the hereafter. Mm. I believe that any physical manifestation of happiness on the remainder of their memory will have an effect on their soul. So I think these little yellow smiley faces are very appropriate.
So a type of prayer expressing to nature in a very specific way what you hope for these people.
Yeah, and sort of speaking of this topic, I heard this thought the other day, which is that although we experience a single physical death, all of us, eventually, the true spiritual death comes much later, and that is the moment when our name and memory is mentioned for the very last time in all of human existence. And it could be that for certain people, their name will never be forgotten. They'll be remain in the history books until all of human civilization is gone. But for the vast majority of us, including most of our ancestors, after a generation or maybe two, their existence will be forgotten.
I think in many cultures, the responsibility of remembering a person lies with one's progeny.
Yeah, but how long can it last? As generations progress, we just can't remember all those names anymore. Well, I mean, does anyone know the name of their great-great-grandparents?
Dr. Glass Vance.
Well, what about the other ones?
Dr. Herbert Vance.
Okay, 13 more.
They're all doctors. Let's see, there's a Cooper Vance. Cooper DeLorean. There are a lot of Coopers, first last names, too. I think I only know about five of them. Five out of 13.
Yeah, so most of them are probably truly dead in a deep spiritual way.
Well, but I think the name isn't the most important part necessarily. For certain cultures it is, but for me, I would say that the actual effects that you've had in the world are the most important effects. So say one day you make fun of a fat person and they, you know, puke and clog up a toilet or something, and that toilet clogs up a whole building, and it, you know, someone flushes a toilet and they get their new suit wet and they go home and kill their wife or whatever, then that effect goes through that other person's family that's completely unrelated to you and creates an entire different course of human history. Huh. If the person with the suit is Adolf Hitler, you know, and he gets arrested before he does his little, you know, massacre thing. So I think the real thing is the butterfly effect that you, the web of effect that you weave on the world. And so each one of us has a huge effect on the future in terms of that will never really go away.
So you're arguing that of all the infinite possibilities of the way the universe could unfold, each one of us has sort of an infinite amount of influence on deciding which paths are not to be followed and which paths may be followed. And together, each generation jointly selects through its actions a single path through this lattice of possibilities.
I'd say definitely, you know, like I won't necessarily affect what next president will be elected, but certain moves that I will make will certainly affect other things in 2012 and in 2000, you know, 2012 or whatever, or 2030-12.
Well, now, caller, I wonder if how you can handle the burden of responsibility, knowing that, you know, whether or not you eat a particular type of burrito this evening, causing you to...
That's pretty much all anyone can do.
Is to eat the... To do what?
To try not to eat too much cheese. And, you know, if you like cheese, just try not to eat too much of the bad stuff. Get some good cheese, you know, don't waste it on American cheese. At least provolone, at the bare minimum, and you should really go all out and get something that you haven't tried before.
I wonder if we should throw out our call-in number in case anyone else wants to join this.
I'm afraid of what the consequences might be.
I'm not afraid.
I think it'll be good.
You are prepared.
I'm willing to take
dare
the risk.
yeah. their fate.
Their I'm fate and their the yeah. wrath of callers. So the number, if anyone wants to join, is 617-253-8810.
I think you just saved a kitten from drowning. Probably.
But maybe somewhere else in the universe, a universe kitten was killed.
Yeah, well, certainly antimatter.
Well, that's fine, kitten. Though, because universe kittens are evil.
Well, I saw a preview for one of these theatrical events, what are they called? Movies, wherein a couple was given a choice to make a decision. They could press some sort of button, and they'd be given $1 million, but with the consequence that somewhere in the world, somewhere, someone would die.
Yeah.
And they have to make this ethical decision about whether to accept $1 million and to accept that some faceless, nameless person elsewhere in the world will die. And I assume that in the movie, they make the decision to accept the money, and then some bad things happen, and I don't know what they are exactly, but I suspect that the person who dies may be someone that they know or actually one of them.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I think they even reveal in the trailer that it's someone related to them. Like, not related, but somebody know.
It looks like that, yeah.
Should be some random dude in China or India, and, you know.
By probability, yes.
By probability. Indonesia. And I would definitely press that button. And I'd press it a couple of times. I'd press it until I'd spent all the money that I could spend, and you know, then I'd probably start a foundation to try to right my wrongs, but not until like at least $1 billion.
Well, actually, I mean, one way, if one is truly, say, a utilitarian, then one might accept the $1 million and use it to save many thousands of lives.
Yeah. Well, I think one human life is probably worth $100,000, somewhere around that. One American life is worth about $3 million. So, you know, I think we live about 50 times more energetically. You know, we use up more resources, 50 times more resources than, like, an Indian or something. So I guess, yeah, that'd be about $20,000. No, I'm sorry, $60,000 for an Indian. So yeah, if you could save, I just got lost in that math. But if you could save more than 10 Indians with $1 million, then I think you'd be okay. And I think you could, you know, you just buy a couple water wheels and throw them over there, and bam, and then you get to, you know, spend the rest on some delicious goudas.
Yes, the philosopher Peter Singer made an interesting argument. He argued that one is actually ethically obligated to spend all their income, besides what they need to survive, on charity to save people's lives.
Definitely.
And he considered this scenario. He said, let's say you've taken all your money and you want to receive a phone call. Then you would probably receive the phone call.
Let's do that now. Or maybe not. I think our caller,
we had an indecisive caller there. But anyway, going back to that argument, he said that suppose you take all your life savings, let's say hundreds of thousands of dollars, and invest it in a car. You buy a Bentley, and you're driving your Bentley, and it gets stuck on a railroad track. And let's say there's a fork in the railroad track, and on the other fork, there's a human being who's stuck in the track. And as it stands now, the train is scheduled to take the right-hand side of the fork and kill the human being. And there's a switch, which allows you to switch the path of the train onto the other fork, which right now will crush your car, because your car is stuck. So by doing nothing, you'll save your car and allow the human to die. By pulling the switch, you will save the human's lives and lose the car, which represents your life savings. So Professor Singer argued that in this scenario, it's obvious to us that the right thing to do is to pull the switch.
to kill the person and save your car, and then you sell the car, and with the proceeds, you save 100 lives.
That is a twist on it, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think the caller also makes a point that not all lives are equal.
Definitely. My life is a lot better than probably most of yours. No offense.
Well, if someone is, let's say, truly miserable, then can we say that their life is worth less than that of a happy person?
I mean, I think in my case, caller, what you say is probably true, not because I'm not enjoying living, but because I'm so close to dying.
Hmm. Right.
Really,
I could kind of hear that. That's why I was directing that mostly towards you. So, obviously, no offense, you're just very old.
No, it's perfectly an evaluation that we can make hypothetically. But another way to arrange things, to perhaps evaluate the value of a person's life, is just how difficult or how much it would cost, how much you would have to pay someone to kill that person.
Hmm.
And in my case, it simply wouldn't be worth it because...
I mean, I imagine that a single poke of a finger on your body would probably result in your demise.
In the right place... Right,
or a loud word.
This reminds me of this issue that's come up politically recently of death panels. And I guess it's been alleged by some that healthcare bills would introduce these death panels where I guess the members of the panel would get to decide who deserves to live and who deserves to die. And I know many people got very worked up about this issue and they thought, oh, is it wrong? Is it right? Is this a lie? Is it a distortion? But my immediate thought was, well, if there are going to be such death panels, I would certainly like to be on them.
Yeah, definitely. I would like to be first in line.
And I wonder
what the
process would be to actually join one of the death panels.
Yeah. You probably need to press a bunch of buttons to get that experience.
Maybe we would need great wisdom, great influence.
Yeah, probably daddy in the law department or something at Stanford. Whatever. I think we really just need a lot more death panels in general, and we kind of let the chips fall where they may after we set those up. You know, whoever wants to get in those, just jump on board. We're gonna have a lot of fun, but we're also doing serious stuff. So casual Fridays, we're still gonna get work done. But
there's no reason why the death panels can't have ice cream parties or pizza dinners.
You know, throw on a piano key necktie t-shirt, you know, go all out, whatever, wear a thong underneath that. I'm not gonna see it. It'll just be your joke. It's all good.
Yeah, it's really about how you can access your own chi and really bring that personality out.
What is chi anyway? Is that a Greek letter?
I think that's right. But
is that
also
a lowercase chi or an uppercase that usually people are referring to?
I think that the people that often refer to the chi do not use languages that involve case. So I'm not sure what the answer is to that one. They would probably capitalize it out of ego. But
yeah.
But in any case,
those Indians, Native Americans.
The spice of a person's essence, I think, the various spices, the spice blend, would all come out and be exposed to the world, and be very loud, and be smelled, smell and kind be of, smelled.
I think smelt is the
smelt.
Upper form, yes.
Especially smelt. If it smells like metal. That metallic tinge you get when you work in the brass factory, making brass.
And
but
I mean, if a rubber thong is the path to permitting that metal to flow, then
and some people like not just the rubber thong, but an entire rubber suit to tightly encase their body. In fact, I've heard of some case, I think it was in Georgia, where the minister of a church was found dead in his house, and he had accidentally asphyxiated himself, wearing not one but two scuba diving suits, and his body was tightly bound, apparently through some form of self-binding.
Yeah, well, I've done that. My girlfriend and I practice safe sex with body condoms, which are available at the Children's Museum gift shop. It's kind of like a scientist. It's a giant balloon kit, but basically, you know, that's what they say it's for. But you know, the real use is the adults know all know about. So it's a way to just cover all bases, and it can get a little stuffy in there. So you got to make sure you finish up in a couple minutes. But it's a lot of fun. I'd really recommend a combo of that and a moonwalk base. If you rent one of those, it's like, you know, $1,000 for a day. You'll get your money's worth. So that's a tip.
Well, caller, unfortunately, we're right out of time.
Perfect timing. I've got to go get my bun out of the oven. So it's been wonderful, and I will catch you cool cats later. All right. Bye.
And it's been wonderful for us as well. Wonderful particularly for me. So thank you also, Professor Levine, for joining me this evening.
It's been my own pleasure. In fact, my pleasure has resurged after its valley of neutrality.
The waxing following the waning.
Right, I believe this would be the waxing, right?
Well, thank you so much. To our listeners also, thank you for joining us and listening once again to our rambling and to joining in where you will. I'm Dr. Jalis Sakran here on Music for Human. Music for Human is New Age Talk Radio with an emphasis on you. Here every Friday at 7 on WMBR 88.1 FM in Cambridge. Stay tuned for Massachusetts Bay and Response. Masalama.
Safety.
Number one.
Cars and bikes stop at red lights.
It's against the law for car drivers or bicycle riders to ignore traffic signals.
So don't buzz through red lights. There might be a pedestrian or turning car that doesn't see you coming.
Number two.
Look first before you open your door.
Numerous bicyclists have been injured or even killed by car doors suddenly opening into them.
Look first, and bicyclists, stay out of the door zone.
Number three.
Cross with the signal.
You are safest if you wait for a walk or green traffic signal.
Don't jaywalk. That's just walking into trouble.
Number four.
Cars and bikes should stop for pedestrians in unsignalized crosswalks.
Be nice. Be legal. Be safe.
Brought to you as a public service by the Cambridge Bicycle Committee and this station.
This is Gina, and you're listening to Massachusetts Bay.
And I'm Brad with Response.
15 minutes of sounds from Squandam Point Park. A pile of rocks reappropriated during World War I to build Navy destroyers. airstrip again. Stereo microphone, hold it in my hand, spin around really slowly, quarter revolution for 15 seconds, trying to figure out what being there has to do with the past.
I'm looking to find things that you would normally see in everyday life that